We're going to be introduced to a new character today, if you will, as we have been looking at the patriarchs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And tonight we're going to be introduced to Joseph, one of Jacob's sons, and literally one-fourth of the whole book of Genesis is dedicated to the story of Joseph. So we'll be here for a few weeks. And, of course, he's known as the dreamer, isn't he? He was well known for not only the dreams that he would have, as we're going to look at those tonight, but also his interpretation of dreams that will factor in the later part of our study of him. And that's a question that I get asked sometimes quite a bit, where people will come and ask me about, does God still speak through dreams today? And it's a good question. You know, I mean, I believe that we could say that God could do whatever he wants. You know, he doesn't need our permission to do it. And if he wants to speak through a dream, then of course he certainly will. And I believe that he still does do that. But we need to understand, when we look at the Bible, you know, the Bible is covering a period chronology of over 3,000 years from the flood up until our current time. And the number of people that have dreams we could count on one hand. And so it's not a commonplace thing. Even in the Bible it wasn't. But we have dreams, and sometimes we wonder if there's a meaning to it, or if it's something supernatural. For example, the other day Sherry had a dream. And we both woke up, she said, "I had this very strange dream last night. It just seemed so vivid and real." And I said, "What was it?" And I said, "Well, I dreamed that you were going to give me this beautiful pearl necklace for our anniversary. Is there anything to that?" And I looked at her and smiled. I said, "Tonight you'll find out." And so that night I came home and I had a box for her, and she very quickly opened it up and she reached in and she pulled out this book that said The Meaning of Dreams. So, you know, a simple guide to life is, this is not working, Hank, I don't know what the thing is, but a simple guide to life is to follow your dreams. You know, you hear that quite often. And I agree with that to a large degree, unless it's the one where you're at the mall in your underwear. You know, I don't necessarily think you ought to follow that one, but for the most part, whatever you think, you know, just go for it. And it says in verse 1 of chapter 37, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father." Now, if you've been with us in our study of Genesis so far, and as we've been looking at the lives of the patriarchs, and by the time we get to Joseph, after the last several weeks of looking at Jacob and his brother Esau and Isaac and Ishmael, and then all of the times when Abraham kind of missed, by the time we get to Joseph, he's the poster child for dysfunctionality. I mean, this guy should, by the time he gets to 17, he should have a rap sheet, you know, because as we would look at his family history and his environment. And yet, as we're going to see, he's a very exceptional man. He defies the odds in the way that he trusts in the Lord and believes in his sovereignty. And when it says that he brings a bad report to his father concerning his brothers, I don't think he was going and tattling on them because he saw them smoking corn silk behind the silo, you know. I don't think it was necessarily anything like that, but it was more likely they were probably doing something that was disrespectful or even dishonest for their father. You know, they were in charge of his flock, and they basically had a great responsibility to handle things accordingly, and they were probably doing something wrong. Now, either Joseph has a really serious lack of discernment in him going against his brothers and bringing this bad report to their father, or he may be, as Robert Baker said, let me turn this off, turn it back on again, Hank, okay? Robert Baker said, "As I grow older, I care less about what people think about me and more about what God thinks of me. I expect to be with him much longer than I am with you." And that's not a bad philosophy to follow, and that may be what was driving Joseph. And it says that Israel, which of course is Jacob's other name, Israel loved Joseph more than all his, Jacob's other name. He loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. You checking the USB? Okay. Yeah, I don't think something's not connecting. And he says he loved Joseph more than all the rest of his children because he was the son of his old age. You know, he was an old guy by the time he had Joseph, and so there was this very special connection between them. And then he says, and then also he had made him a coat of many colors. Please understand that I'm not going to be speaking heresy in what I say here. I mean, I'm standing on pretty sound ground when I say to you that the coat of many colors. I went to Sunday school too, and I had the lessons in VBS about Joseph's coat of many colors. But it's probably better translated coat with sleeves. The word that is used here is katonet pasim, and it's a rarely used word, but it means has a root meaning of from the palm of the hand or the sole of the foot. And it was the idea that just, you know, in that agrarian culture, when they wore their robes, they would have them in such a way that they didn't hinder their working when they go out in the field. And so somebody that had long robes, long sleeves and a big all the way down to the ground robe was somebody that was in a role of being important, and you were the boss. You didn't need to get your sleeves dirty, and so this was more than just simply Jacob showing favoritism to Joseph in his brother's eyes, but it was a certain statement of beyond just simple preferential treatment, but maybe what Jacob's future intentions for Joseph might be. It's kind of interesting, I think, that just as it was parental favoritism that separated him from his mother, right? Remember when the whole thing where he acted like he was Esau, when Jacob acted like he was Esau and kind of posed as Esau before Isaac to receive Esau's blessing. And it was parental favoritism that separated him from his mother in the beginning, and now it's going to separate him from his son. And I wonder how many times when he was realizing all this favoritism that Isaac had shown to Esau. He was his favorite son, and he liked him because he was a man of the field, and he'd go out and kill the wildebeest and then come home and cook it. And Isaac liked Esau better. How many times do you think Jacob might have said, when I grow up, if I'm a dad, I'm never going to do that? That he was going to learn from the mistake of his father, and yet he grows up only to do that himself. And it says, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So they've gone from hating him to hating him even more now because of this dream. And he said to them, please hear this dream which I've dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. And then behold, you know, this is the Bible way of saying pay attention. He said, hey, check this out. My sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. I mean, does Joe have a death wish? You know, I mean, what is it? He's got to know that they're not like him, or maybe he's just got this thing about being truthful and being honest. And I don't think that we can present Joseph as being sinless. I don't think we can present him as being definitely innocent of all these things that happens. You know, he may be somewhat naive, but he is portrayed as a very good example of integrity and truthfulness. And his brother said in verse 8, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more. So they've gone from hating him to hating him even more. Now they're hating him even more for his dreams and for his words. I mean, their hatred right now is rapidly approaching critical mass. And then he dreamed still another dream, and he told it to his brother, and he said, look, behold, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me. And so he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And check out what verse 11 says. And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. You know, Jake's been around long enough to be able to know when God's up to something. And there's something going on here that even though he rebuked his son for this dream, he still knows that there's something happening. Sandy Adams, Calvary Chapel pastor down in Atlanta, said, "For 14 chapters, we're going to embark on a journey with Joseph. We're going to follow him from the pit to the Potiphar's, to prison, and finally to the palace. And Joseph's life is a showcase for another P, and that's providence. For God is sovereign over all situations." One of the things that just causes me to stand in awe of Joseph's example is with all of the things that he's going to be facing over the next quarter of the book of Genesis, he never once lost sight of that, that God was sovereign. And there was never a time where he didn't know that if there was any reason why God didn't want him going through what he was going through, that God would change it. And not only did he accept that, but he could rest in it as well. So then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. Now, Shechem was the place we looked at last time. You know, this is where Dinah got raped, and then the sons went in there and wiped out the whole city, all the males in the city and everything. What are they doing going up there? I mean, for one thing, that's a long way from where they were staying down in Hebron. But what are they doing going all the way up to Shechem? I mean, shouldn't they know better? Shouldn't they know that that's not a good place? Shouldn't they know that that's a place where they could be faced with all kinds of negativity and dangers and temptations? And why would they go there? For the same reason that we do. You know, for the same reason why we go places where we shouldn't go and look at what we shouldn't look and do what we shouldn't do. And verse 13 says, Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." And so he said to him, "Please go and see if it's well with your brothers and well with the flock, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, which is just to the west side of the Dead Sea, and then he went to Shechem. You know, maybe Jacob's the one that's lacking discernment. I mean, surely he's seen the animosity that his brothers have toward, Joseph's brothers have toward him. Surely he's seen that. You know, he's kind of worried about him, though. I mean, he hasn't received a text or anything for several days, and they're up there in this place. The last time they were up there, the guy said, "If you come back here, we won't kill you." And so his sons are up there, and he sends Joseph up there. He leaves the valley of Hebron and goes up to Shechem. The word Hebron in the Hebrew, it comes from a Hebrew word that means association or community. And he left the fellowship. And check this out. Check this out. A lot of guys have noticed that there, and I haven't sat down and counted these, but if you want something to do tonight, you can. There have been a lot of commentators that have realized, as they look at the story of Joseph, they realize that there are over 100 parallels between Joseph and Jesus. That there are over 100 ways that either he as an individual or his circumstances parallels are a type of that of Jesus. For example, he leaves fellowship with the Father to go find his brothers, right? And it says, "Now a certain man," verse 15, "found him, and there he was, wandering in the field." So he gets up to the area of Shechem, and he's just kind of walking around, seeing if maybe he can find his brothers somewhere. And the man said, "What are you seeking?" He said, "I'm seeking my brothers." And he says, "Please tell me where they are feeding the flocks." And again, another one, Matthew 13:38, remember the parable of the soils, and Jesus interprets it later where he says to them that the field is the world. And so Jesus goes into the world to seek and save those who are lost. And this Joseph has gone into the world to find his brothers and to seek him, or seek them. And so the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, you know, he's got this coat, technicolor coat, right? Got all kinds of daisies and tie-dye and everything on it, and he just kind of stands out. And so as they see him coming, Even before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him. The name Dothan means two cisterns. Okay, in those days, a cistern was basically a hollowed out piece in the rock. The semi-arid area that don't get a whole lot of rainfall, and what they do, they try to collect and save because water is such a precious commodity there. And so this is known for a place that has not one but two cisterns, and that's where it got its name. In fact, we're probably going to be introduced to one of those two cisterns very closely in a few minutes. Jeremiah chapter 2 verse 13 says, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fount of living waters," in other words, they've left Hebron, if you will, in the typology, "and hewn for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can have no hold on water." So then verse 19 says, "They said to one another, look, the dreamer is coming." Interesting, the word dreamer, if we were to look at it in the original Hebrew, it's two words in Hebrew. It's the word Baal, which is the word for, you know, the Lord, or a lot of the pagan gods of that area were named Baal, and then they would have some word or description following it. And the name for dreamer is Baal Kalom, which means master or the Lord of dreams. Here comes the master of dreams, you know, the Lord of dreams. "Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit or some cistern. And we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. And we will see what becomes of his dreams." But Reuben heard it. Remember, Reuben's the firstborn. He's the head of the clan of brothers. And he says to them, he delivered him out of their hands. And he said, "Let's not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but let's cast him in this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him." He was thinking he might deliver them out of his hands and might bring him back to his father. You know, what Reuben is trying to do, is that just, what's that doing now? Just go back. Reuben is trying to somehow intervene on Joseph's behalf. He's feeling a little bit of the responsibility that he has as the head brother. And he's saying, well, let's just put him in this pit. And his mind thought, thinking was that then he was going to come back later when the other bros weren't looking, and he was going to scoop him out. And we kind of see, I think, with him a type of Pilate, where he was wanting to wash his hands of the matter and think that somehow he could be innocent because he was trying to pacify them in their anger and thinking that would somehow take care of it. But it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic. I remember another man that was stripped of his tunic, right? Right before he went into his time of trial. And again, we see another type of Joseph or type of Jesus in Joseph. And so they stripped him of his tunic, and that was the coat of many colors, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. So it was probably one of these two cisterns that the place was named after, and this was a dry cistern. There just wasn't any rain, so they thought they could throw him down in that. And after they did, it says they sat down and ate lunch. You know, they threw their kid brother down in a hole, and they sat down to eat lunch. And then they lifted up their eyes, and look, there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So they were on a caravan of Ishmaelites were going from, you've heard the term balm of Gilead. Well, that was, they were, it was an area where this salve was, they were pretty famous for that, and they had gotten a bunch of that and maybe some from even further east, and then they were taking it down to trade in Egypt. And verse 26 says, "And Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" You know, Let's get something out of it. We're going to kill him. Let's do it and see what we can get from it. So come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. So he's saying, we don't kill him. Let's just sell him into slavery down into Egypt, and we'll make a few bucks out of the deal. And his brothers listened. So as Reuben, I think, is a type of Pilate where he just kind of wanted to wash his hands of the situation, I think what we have in Judah is a type of Judas. In fact, the name Judas is the Hellenized version of the Hebrew name of Judah. And he's saying, let's make something out of the deal. And so the Midianite trainers passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and then sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. And then Reuben returned to the pit, you know, thinking he'd go back. And he evidently... you know, now it says throughout the passage here, it says Ishmaelites in verses 25 and 27, as you see, and then it says Midianites in verses 28. What is the difference here? The Ishmaelites were descendants of Abraham through Keturah. Remember Abraham's second wife. And the, through Hagar, the handmaiden. And the Midianites were descendants of Abraham through his second wife, Keturah. So they were kind of sort of related, but not exactly. But the name Ishmaelites is kind of a generic name for the Arabic people in that day. That's just, Ishmaelites is kind of a catch-all phrase for them. And so they sold him for 20 shekels of silver. Now, how many shekels did Judas betray Jesus for? It was 30, right? I mean, if there's such a typology here between Joseph and Jesus, why did they, I mean, it would have been better for him to say, we'll sell him to you for 40 shekels, and then they say, no, we'll do it for 20, and then they say, no, okay, and then they arrive at 30, and then it would have been a better typology. Why is it? I don't know. You know, a couple thousand years separate them. I guess inflation, you know, maybe 20 shekels of silver is what 30 shekels of silver would be worth by the first century. But he returned, evidently Reuben had been down to the on cue getting a Bang energy drink because he was gone when all this was happening. And so when he comes back, he returned, he said, the lad is no more. And where shall I go? You know, I'm in charge of him. I'm going to have to go back and answer to dad for him. What am I going to do? And so they took Joseph's tunic and they killed a kid of the goats and they dipped the tunic in the blood. And then they sent the tunic of many colors and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? You know, they said, Dad, we were just kind of out there up in the north around Dothan area, and we were walking along just feeding the flock and everything, and we saw this old matted up, twisted and torn and bloody garment. And it kind of, I mean, we never really paid any attention before. I mean, we're not sure, but you think, is it possible? I mean, Joseph's been with you all this time, hasn't he? I mean, could this possibly be Joseph's coat, do you think? And of course, he recognized it, verse 33, and said, it is my son's tunic. And a wild beast has devoured him. You know, Jacob's just kind of putting the pieces together, and he's figuring he got beat up by a lion. And without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. So then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters. Now, we only know the name of one of the daughters, Dinah. But it says here daughters, so whether this is talking about other daughters that he had had through the four women or whether it's talking about granddaughters, some daughters that were born to the 10 sons other than Joseph, not sure. But it says all of his sons and all of his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, I'll go down to the grave to my son in mourning. And thus his father wept for him. Could you imagine what it was like when all these brothers who knew the truth, they knew what they had done, and they're coming along and they're trying to weep with him and they're trying to console him and they're saying, no, Dad, we know it hurts so bad. We really love Joe and we wish he was here. And the act that must have been put on. You know, earlier, Jacob had been deceived or had used a goat to deceive his father Isaac, right? When he killed the goat and then took the skin and put it on his arms to make his father think that he was Esau. And here, Joseph is being, we could call, the scapegoat, as he this would be the one in the Yom Kippur sacrifice. They would have the two goats, and they would kill the one, and then they'd put the blood of that one on the other one, and that one would be driven into the wilderness. And Joseph is kind of, and that was called the scapegoat or the a scapegoat. And as Joseph has been, they think, his dad thinks that he's been killed, but actually he was driven off into the wilderness, and he is, Joseph was the sacrifice, the scapegoat in this case. And the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. The word officer here in the Old Testament language is the word saris, which most of the occurrences of it in the Old Testament, not always, not exclusively, but most of the times we see that word in the Hebrew word in the Old Testament, it's the word is translated by our English word eunuch. Don't know if that's the case of Potiphar or not. We can't know that for sure. It seems to be that it was kind of in the later writings that it was translated that way, but if it was, if this is the actual meaning of the word, it's going to shed a lot of light on what's going on when we get next week with Mrs. Potiphar and the way she's acting around Joseph. But here Joseph, who has only wanted what was right for his dad, he's tried to be a good son, he's been a faithful son, he's worked hard, he's represented his dad's interests on numerous occasions, and all he was doing was honoring his dad's wishes to go find the 10 brothers and make sure everything was okay and then come back and give Jake an update on it. And here all of these things are happening to him. Pretty dire time in Joseph's life. In fact, as we look at the book of Genesis and we look at similar stories that have happened previously, like when Jacob was running from Esau and he had the vision of the coat or the ladders with the angels going up and down, and the night that he wrestled with the angel as he was going back 20 years later, he was going to meet with Esau a second time. And every time there's in this big time of Jacob's life, God would appear in the person of a theophany, right? Which is a physical manifestation of the Son of God. This would be a good time for a theophany, I would think. I mean, if we were Joseph, I think, you know, hello, God, could you send your son down here for a minute? I mean, this would be a pretty good time for a vision, or, I mean, he has all these dreams, why not a dream? You know, something that would encourage him and something that would soothe him and just let him know that God hadn't turned his back on him. But Joe gets nothing. God's not talking. God's not appearing. God's not manifesting. Joseph is doing the epitome of what we would today call the faith walk. And it came to pass at that time, verse 1 of chapter 38, that Judah... Now, I don't know where... 38 is going to sound like... Chapter 38 seems really out of place to the story. I mean, it just doesn't flow between 37 and 39. You know, it's like it's just been inserted there in the middle of it. It's, I mean, like Moses was writing it down and he stopped to have a coffee break, and when he came back, he forgot where he was at, and so he just, you know, kind of lost the continuity of it, is what it kind of sounds like. But it's, you know, God put it here for a purpose, and it has a reason. And it's going to tell, we're going to go backwards a little bit, and we're going to learn this story a little bit about Judah, the one who came up with the idea of selling Joseph to the Midianites. It says, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and then went into her. You know, he'd had the example of his uncle doing the same thing where Esau had married the Canaanite women. And so Judah sees a gal. It's kind of almost sounds like the story of Samson, doesn't it? I saw this Philistine and go get her for me, Dad. Judah saw this Canaanite and he liked what he saw. And so he married her and he went into her and she conceived and bore a son. And he called his name Ur. Now, I know I make fun of a lot of the Hebrew names, but and this is probably one of the better ones, but could you imagine He named his son Ur. You know, his son's born, and so Jacob goes up to him and says, what are you going to call him? He goes, Ur. And Jacob, it sounds good to me, you know, and that became his name from then on. And so he conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. And she conceived again, and she bore him another son. He's kind of graduated two syllables now, and he says his name is Onan. And then she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name. This is pretty good. And she called his name Shelah. You know, that was, there was this really big kind of a country crossover record that was big back in those days called A Boy Named Shelah. He was at Chezeb when she bore him. And then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. So some time has passed. You know, this isn't just a nighttime thing. I mean, there's been several years have gone by. And he took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. And so Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. Now, this becomes codified later on in the Judaic law. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, we have the law of what's called the Levirate marriage. And it was customary, as we can see, this is several centuries before Moses and the law, but it was customary in that day and age. In fact, there are some ancient writings that kind of allude to this, that it would be customary if a person got married, if a gal married and the husband died before he was able to bring a male offspring, an heir to his possessions, that it would be the responsibility of the closest relative to the widow that he would take her as his wife. And then the first son that they had would be considered to be the heir of the deceased brother or cousin or whatever the relationship may be. And so this is what Jacob is saying to Onan. Ur has died, so you go take Tamar, marry her, and then give up, produce a son in your dead brother's honor. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife, that he admitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. I'm sure there are times when, you know, there's the preachers that do the standard topical message. You know, they just do a topic every Sunday and every Wednesday. And I'm sure there are times in every pastor's heart that has come from that tradition where they're setting up like 11 o'clock on a Saturday night wondering what they're going to preach the next day and just waiting for God to give them some sort of a topic to preach on. As a verse-by-verse guy, I ain't never got that problem. And I'm really down with being verse-by-verse. But there are times when I just like to skip one. You know, I like it to be verse by the next verse and skip over one somewhere. And this would, verse 9 would be one of those. So let's just skip it, okay? Let's just go on to verse 10. You know, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, it's just exactly the way it said it. And it says that the thing in verse 10 displeased the Lord. And therefore, he killed him also. You know, Onan was only interested in his personal sexual gratification. And that was displeasing to the Lord. Reading anything more into that, I think, is too much. But he didn't want to bring an heir to his brother's memory. He wanted to, whatever sons he had, he wanted to be his sons. And so, but he did want to have relations with Tamar. And so then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah. You know, he's growing up kind of hard. He's too young to get married yet. So wait till my son Shelah is grown, and lest he also die like his brothers, Judah said. And so Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So she's just going to wait for a few years until Shelah is marrying age, and then they'll try it again. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted, You know, he had his time of mourning. And then he went up to his sheep shearers in Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Dulamite. And so, you know, his wife had died, and he's gone through his typical mourning time, and they were doing this annual sheep shearing thing there in Canaanite country of Timnah. And so he's going up. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." And so she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown and that she was not given to him as a wife. So when Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot, because that's, you know, it was a big sheep shearing thing. It's where all the guys went. And in that pagan culture of that day, you know, it was all about reproduction and all that, the fertility rites of the paganism. And so these, you know, temple prostitutes, if you will, these pagan prostitutes would be hiding out there or being waiting there where all the guys would be coming for their sheep shearing thing. And that was even considered to be part of their religiosity. And it says when Judah saw her, verse 15, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. She was wearing a veil. So he didn't realize it was his daughter-in-law. And so he turned to her by the way, and she said, and he said, "Please let me come into you," which is Bibleese for, "Hey, baby, you looking for a date?" And for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And so she said, "Well, what would you give me that I may come into you? For I..." And then he says, "I will send a young goat from the flock." And so she said, "Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And he said, "Your signet cord and your staff that's in your hand," which is Bibleese for "We accept Visa and two forms of ID." You know, your signet, they didn't have signet rings in those days. It would be this big stone or clay thing that they'd wear around their neck. And the word signature comes from that. And it was, you know, it was like your Social Security card, you know, your Social Security number. I mean, this was your own personal ID. And so for him to give that to her, that would be a pretty good sign that he was going to come back and pay what he should later. And so he gave them to her and then went into her, and she conceived by him. And so she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and then put on the garments of her widowhood. So as soon as Judah heads on down the road, she takes off the prostitute, you know, the micro mini skirt and the stiletto heels, and put on her black widow garments again. And then Judah sent a young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, for he did not find her. But he did not find her. And so his friend, the Adullamite, is going all around that area of Timnah and saying, "Where's the widow that used to kind of, or the prostitute that would hang out in this place?" And he said, "Where's the harlot who was openly by the wayside?" And they said, "There's no harlot in this place. You know, you don't got no harlots around here." And so he returned to Judah and said, "I can't find her." And so also the men of the place said, "There's no harlot in this place." And so Judah said to him, "Well, let her take them for herself," meaning this down payment that he had given her, this collateral. He said, "Let her just have it for herself," because he would rather lose his signet thing than to have it be openly aired that he had gone to see a prostitute. So he says, "Let her take him for himself, lest we be shamed, for I sent this young goat, and you have not found her." You know, I wouldn't want anybody to know that I'd sent a prostitute. And so it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and furthermore, she's with child by harlotry." And so Judah is livid when he hears this. And he says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." It could be, as Matthew Henry says, and that may be more the product of his generation, but it could be that he says, "Bring her out and let her be branded," you know, during the Middle Ages where they would put that big brand that the A in the forehead of women that were caught in adultery. It could be that he's saying something along those lines. But he says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Whatever it was, you know, whether you're saying let her be cooked, you know, burn up, or whether you're saying let her be branded so she can wear the marks of her illicit activity for the rest of her life, We don't know. But I think the one takeaway from this, the one thing that we can know for sure, and if there's anything that's clear in what the Bible says, and anything that has been very clear to me in my own personal life and my time as a pastor and as a Bible student, all of those come to say one thing, and one thing unmistakably: illicit sex scars. Period. It brands, it burns you. You know, there is no mistaking it. There's no escaping it. It's God has this one thing that He designed. When He told Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply," that wasn't the only reason why He gave them the joy of marital intimacy, just so we can have a lot of babies going around. You know, that's one of the reasons, obviously, but that's not the only reason. And it is not just so that we can have fun in the sack. That's part of the reason, but that's not the only reason. The reason why He chose Adam and Eve and put them together and said, they called this thing, that this union between them, holy matrimony, is because, as Paul explains to us in Ephesians chapter 5, that when two people come together, they become one flesh. And that's God's intention, because it pictures the relationship between the bride, the church, and the bridegroom, who is Jesus Christ. And God's been very clear about that. If there's anything in Scripture that's from Genesis to Revelation, that's it. And when we do anything that's outside of that, He blesses. He says the marriage bed is pure and honorable and undefiled. God invented sex. He didn't have a problem with it at all. But it's like a fire. You know, the fire is good when it's kept inside the fireplace. When it's used for cooking, when it's used for the purpose it was given to us, fire is a good thing. But you get it outside the fireplace, you spill the grease on the cook fire, it's bad juju. And illicit sex scars. And I don't know how many times I've prayed with people who have been so scarred by the lies that our culture pervades today. And when she was brought out, verse 25, she sent to her father-in-law saying, you know, he's saying, I want to know who did this. And so she says, well, it was the guy to whom these belong. I'm with child. You know, they brought out the signet and his staff. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet and the cord that the signet hung by and the staff. You know, kind of like the same sort of charade that the brothers had played with their dad regarding the coat. Jacob's coat or Joseph's coat. So I don't know who these are. Whoever gave these, whoever owns these, that's who the dad is. And so Judah acknowledged them and said, sure, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son. And then he never knew her again. And it came to pass, you know, probably be a good time for the end of a chapter, but we still goes on. It says it came to pass at the time of giving birth that behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that one put out his hand. You know, I've heard of breech bursts, but I never heard of fist bursts before. But this one of them put out his hand. And so the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, just basically identifying, okay, this is going to be the firstborn. And, you know, the scarlet thread is just such a type of the Lord's sacrifice. If you've ever read the essay, The Scarlet Thread of Redemption, Rahab and the scarlet thread that she hung and all of that. But the midwife tied a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying this one came out first. But then it happened that he drew his hand back in. And then his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? You know, the other one was in line, but I know it's not you because you don't have the scarlet thread around your hand. How did you break through? And so this breach be upon you, which, you know, not a curse or anything like that. You're just saying you're the one that broke through, which is what the word breach means. And so afterwards, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand. And the first one was called Perez, which means break or division or breaking away, a pulling away. And his brother was named Zerah. Genesis 38 is one of the clearest examples for the inspiration of Scripture that you can find anywhere. Nobody could make this stuff up. You know, nobody that was trying to write a holy book and make people think that this was written by God would put Genesis 38 in there. And yet God shows his people with warts and all. You know, this is how it happened. This is the way it was. And this is how God has preserved it for us. It's interesting. There are four women in Jesus' genealogy. Bathsheba is mentioned, but only as the wife of Uriah. But there's four women that are given in Jesus' genealogy, which I think is significant because most genealogies don't contain the names of women. But you got Tamar, and then Rahab, Tamar the harlot, Rahab the harlot, Ruth, and then Bathsheba as Uriah's wife, and then Mary. Interesting. Deuteronomy 23:2 says, "And one of illegitimate birth," so this is talking about Peros and Zerah, but they were illegitimate, "but one of illegitimate birth shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord." I'm not real sure if this applies in this case or not, but it's talking about those that will go serve at within the tabernacle. But the word illegitimate birth, if you've got the NIV, it says birth of forbidden marriage. It's a very obscure word. It's only used two times in the Old Testament, Mamzer. And it's used here and then also in Zechariah chapter 9:6, where it says a mixed race, and that's that word Mamzer again, shall settle in Ashdod. So not real sure if Deuteronomy 23 is talking about illegitimate childbirth or not, but I think it is very interesting where it says that they won't serve until the 10th generation. And if we start at Perez and go 10 generations down from Perez, you know, the illegitimate guy that breached, we come to David. In Ruth 4:18-22, we're given that whole genealogy. And I think the only reason why, just obscure little passage in Ruth, and it gives these 10 generations just to show that David would be the 10th from Perez, which is kind of cool. Let's go ahead and pray. Lord, we do thank you for your word. We thank you for its clarity. We thank you for the parts that are awkward. And we thank you for the parts that we can embrace and relish. We thank you for the promises of your faithfulness. We thank you of the lesson that we have from Joseph, who even when he was mistreated and when he was just the victim of untold injustice, he never took his eyes off you. And God, we've got so much more than what he had, don't we? We thank you for the strength that you give us through your Spirit. We thank you for the assurance that comes through your word, that we too may remain faithful as we walk in this life under the sun. We pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Do you think maybe